Welcome to the Psych to Practice podcast, a podcast designed to blend information, resources, and collaboration to energize your practice and your life. I'm your host, Dr. Ray Christner, and we are going to take a deep dive into all things mental health. My experience, passion, and a bit of luck has provided me with incredible opportunities. Of these, what strikes me the most are the many conversations where I hear not only the information that others have to share, but their passion behind it. On this podcast, I'm looking to bring you the same experience. We'll talk with experts, practitioners, each other, and most importantly, you. Now, get ready. Let's get psyched to practice. Hey everyone, welcome to the Psych to Practice podcast. I'm your host, Ray Christner, and with me is my esteemed colleague, Paul Wagner.
Hey Ray, thanks. And, an insightful, I think I found myself throughout the episode thinking that, really insightful episode, and so happy to get to share it with you here today. And we're diving into adult ADHD, and we had an opportunity to really go over that with Russell Ramsey, and, just a wealth of knowledge.
Yeah. And I mean, I have followed his work for many years have read, I think, pretty much all of the books that he's done. He's just such a wealth of information. For those of you who maybe don't know Dr. Ramsey, Dr. Russell Ramsey is co-founder and co-director of the University of Pennsylvania's Adult ADHD Treatment and Research Program. And he is a professor of clinical psychology in the Department of Psychiatry in the Perelman School of Medicine at University of Pennsylvania. He is the author of a number of books, one of my favorites being the Adult ADHD Toolkit.
Right. Like, I just feel like it's such a dense episode, but in a really good way, and a lot of just great information there. And I had a hard time kind of thinking for myself, but what stood out for you throughout the episode?
Yeah, there was a lot of information. Russ is just, he's just a wealth of knowledge. So I could have gone on for that, listening to him for, another hour. For me, I think that one of the things he said, just kind of, as somebody who is like CBT and uses CBT a lot, he made a comment about cognition is not a causal factor, but using CBT as a way to kind of look at maybe other aspects, and using the cognition piece, I thought was important. So it's not that, while it's not a causal factor, the thoughts that someone has with ADHD going into situations might impact kind of their behavior, or kind of what's happening. So just that little comment made me maybe view it a little different. So it was a kind of a simple but good takeaway for me. And what were your thoughts?
I like that. And even just as you're saying it there, like hearing that idea of, even though it's not causal, it's still really important and sure, plays an important right. piece in the treatment process. And, I think what stood out for me is along a similar vein. He kind of goes over how we have, especially with like the DSM and just kind of, the education, this reliance in this kind of view of ADHD and how we're working to adapt that and having it be a broader focus on executive functioning or executive dysfunction, how important that is. And the importance of tailoring our treatment strategies to address not only those various areas of executive functioning, but also the complexities that come along with adulthood that we don't see with children or adolescents, and being able to make sure that, we're not just putting this narrow focus on ADHD, but we can really kind of capture the entire impact that it has when in our treatment.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I think that all of those aspects were just, eye-opening and always good to consider. And, for those of you listening, if you have some takeaways or things that, you'd like to share about this episode, please join us on all major social medias, including our community on Facebook.
And with that, we hope you enjoy this Masters in Practice episode of Adult ADHD with Dr. Russell Ramsey.
Russ, thank you so much for taking time to join Paul and I on the Psych to Practice podcast.
Ray and Paul, thank you for having me. I'm honored to be here.
Yeah, really appreciate it. Always feels like a busy week. And so to make some time on a Friday, you know, hopefully getting you out of maybe some notes or maybe we're detracting from some notes, but certainly appreciate it.
And any excuse to share a little bit about what we're doing. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's wonderful. Thanks so much. So Russ, we like to start off our podcast getting to know our guest a little bit and sharing maybe a little bit of a personal story to our listeners. So can you tell us a little bit, how did you actually get into mental health and becoming a psychologist?
You know what? I was an undeclared major. I went to college at the University of Miami in the 80s when Hurricane football, Michael Irvin was down there, Jerome Brown. So just taking a lot of classes. And I remember it was a Psych 102 class, I think a biological basis of behavior. And it just struck me as really interesting. And so the next semester I said, well, let me try this out. I took three more psychology courses in one semester. And I said, this seems like it would be interesting for a long time. And it has proven to be right. Pushing on 40 years later, maybe a little less than that. But so that's really what started it out for me. And if you want me to move forward, so I was on track to graduate with a psychology degree from Miami and found that admission to a doctoral program in clinical psychology is really competitive. So I've always been a good student, but I went through two application go rounds where I know I'm dating myself, but two rounds of only getting skinny envelopes back saying, thank you very much. Many qualified applicants. Don't call us. We'll call you. But I was persistent. So the third go around, I got into Pacific Graduate School of Psychology, which has since been renamed Palo Alto University. And, I love graduate school, you know, all the courses in psychology. And it's, like I said, I think this would be interesting for a long time. Even my pleasure reading very often has something to do with psychology, even if it's fiction or it got referenced somewhere in a book I was reading. So I still find the topic fascinating, maddening and fascinating.
That's right. Yeah, it's interesting. We've as we talk to guests, how many people it's this one class that kind of captures their interest. And it was that way for me. And I think for others, it's always interesting to hear that. That's kind of a story. As you've kind of gone through your career, you know, as all of us, we have, you know, all these mentors and people who kind of have inspired us. Are there some people in your career that stand out as those that have kind of guided you to where you're at today?
Yeah, I mean, two that stand out who I always thank, my undergraduate mentor, Dr. Leonard Jacobson at Miami, who just got me involved in my senior honors thesis and pushed me to do things and exposed me to things I hadn't been exposed to before. And my graduate mentor, Dr. Anita Green, my dissertation thesis advisor. What I always say about Anita and our research group, we were never asked to do something that we weren't ready to do. But we never got away with not doing something that we were more than prepared to do. The other thing I liked about two of them, each of them, and why I sought them out, other people avoided taking their classes because they were difficult. So I said, you know, if I really want to do this well, I want to go to somebody who's going to push me. So they both did in very supportive, appropriate ways. But like that line about Anita, wouldn't get away with not doing something I was perfectly ready to do, which has served me well. And, you know, went to Penn as a postdoctoral fellow at the Center for Cognitive Therapy in the mid-90s. And the people there who are my mentors have become my colleagues. So those are sort of the carbon-based influences. You know what? Along the way, you know, apart from a class, I remember one of my practicum classes in graduate school, we would review books relevant to our practicum placements. And I had the serendipitous good fortune of reviewing Dr. Beck's Cognitive Therapy for Depression manual. Wow. And it really, I mean, I got exposed, you know, I'm fascinated by the different models of understanding human behavior and emotions and cognition, but that Beck book really resonated for me. And I was very fortunate that the professors in cognitive behavioral therapy had a similarly integrative, eclectic view. So some of the works by Michael Mahoney and the book Human Change Processes was really influential for me in grad school. I reread it during COVID. Now, you never read the same book twice. And it's, you know, some of it, you know, I'm looking back and going, oh, well, you know what? You know, the field has matured since, I forget, I think it was published in 91. But, you know, I could see where at that time, it was the right book at the right time for looking for that, the broad base. So those are, and, you know, within ADHD, I've found it a fascinating topic. And it's really pulled on diverse literatures. Going back to the biological basis of behavior, I found it fascinating, but I wouldn't say I was heading towards neuropsychology, but the neuropsychology pieces of it, the genetic predisposition, the interaction with environment and genes, how do you define a diagnosis versus not? And how do you help people to do things that they're struggling to do? I mean, it's really cuts across a gamut of things. So there's a host of colleagues whose works I admire and respect and cite fully and credit them. But it's just such an interesting topic, and it just cuts across so many avenues of human nature and human behavior.
So Russ, you're so well known for all the work you do with adult ADHD. How'd that become your focus and your specialty?
It found me. I did not go to graduate school. I did not arrive at Penn with any burning desire. I probably had all the same misconceptions as anybody else about ADHD.
Yeah.
I think I had just gotten on like the initial faculty appointment, like an instructor. You know, that's sort of like, I don't know, daycare or preschool as compared to real school, on a faculty track, if you will. And so I was at the Center for Cognitive Therapy, getting trained there and figuring out, really didn't have a specialty other than CBT. So March 8th, 1999, I was invited to meet with Dr. Tony Rothstein, a psychiatrist at the University of Pennsylvania, very noted child psychiatrist in Philadelphia, made Philadelphia Magazine's top docs every year. And he had recently become the adult residency director within the Department of Psychiatry. So, you know, my line about Tony, there are those of us who know Tony, and everybody else is about to know Tony. He got my name from Dr. Corey Newman, still there as the clinical director of the Center for Cognitive Therapy, and went in to meet with Tony. And he was saying, and this is about the time the book Driven to Distraction came out, mid-90s, maybe late, a little, well, 99. And Tony was interested in starting an adult ADHD program because he said there's a lot more out there about this. He had noticed in his own clinical caseload, many of the children and teens he saw over the years, they didn't grow out of it. And he was still working with them. And he said, you know, that Tony could handle the medications, but it seemed like we needed some sort of like psychosocial or behavioral treatment. Would I be interested? And the line I use with us, everything interests both of us and we can't say no to work. So I sort of shrugged my shoulders and said, sure. And I'll say I'm dispositionally lazy. So there may have been like 4 or 5 outcome studies on psychosocial treatments at that time, maybe. So we worked together, sort of modified the CBT model at the same time. Some other groups were independently doing that, like Steve Safran at Harvard, Mary Salanto at the time. I forget where she was. Columbia, maybe. I might have that wrong. Mount Sinai. Susan Young out in the UK, but these independent groups were sort of along the same track. And that's so really it found me. And it was like one of those things, just being willing to say yes to something and see how it worked out and try it for a while. And here we are. What does it add up to? Like 20, 23 years or however many, doing the math off the top of my head, 24 years later, I guess, or about to be 24 years later. Here I am.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, as you're telling that story, I'm thinking, you know, I guess maybe I didn't realize how much in infancy the adult ADHD literature is. So we weren't only talking, like you all were doing all this work and some other groups, but we're not talking that long ago that, you know, some of these approaches really were just kind of getting underway.
Yeah. And it's really exponentially exploded over the years, relatively, right. Relatively. Sure. It's still a niche, but yeah, the early days, it was some chart review studies. Our early studies were open studies of our regular clinical caseload, not randomized. It was all IRB right. approved and consented, but you know, it was people with comorbidities or whatever, but you know, that, you know, data are data and they all have trade-offs. So yeah. And there's been a lot of talented clinician researchers over the years and a lot of people, unlike me, stumbling into it, maybe even starting and seeking out training in this. So, and there's many more adult ADHD programs around, so specialty programs. So it's got a nice evidence-based foundation. In fact, I was just recently asked to join a group where starting to come up with some more guidelines for the assessment and treatment. There are many groups that are coming up, like there's a European consensus and other ones, but you know, also some like in the US now too.
Well, and Russ, we're using the term adult ADHD, and I think probably the majority of our listeners probably have some concept of that, but wanting to make sure we're on the same page. So when we're using that term, what is adult ADHD, and you know, how does that differentiate between other periods developmentally? What is it that we're really talking about here?
Right. We're really just talking about the developmental trajectory of ADHD. Now, is it ADD or ADHD? The official, if you want to go by DSM, the ICD, it is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And I can understand the quibble people have. I think it's the only twofer. It has deficit and disorder. In case you missed the first one, we're going to make sure you get it on the back end. There was a time, I think DSM-3, it was still attention deficit disorder, either with or without hyperactivity, but all sort of getting around the same thing. So there is not a separate listing of symptoms for ADHD. There is some modification on the number of symptoms to be endorsed for adults compared with children. But we're really just talking about the separation of the age groups, children, adolescents, and then adults. And really, there are some different manifestations of ADHD based on ongoing brain development and the degree of the self-regulation or self-control we have at different ages. But what is thought to be consistent across time and seems to be supported by the literature is that ADHD is defined as developmental and inappropriate levels of inattention, hyperactivity, and impulsivity. We're really thinking about the field now. Those descriptions are not wrong. They're elements of it, but it's incomplete based on how the field's thinking about it. I'm using a line from Russell Barkley, probably one of the leading figures in ADHD, recently retired, fully retired, because when he was semi-retired, it only meant like two books a year and like right. 80 workshops and things like that. We're really thinking about, and within DSM, ADHD is part of the neurodevelopmental disorders. And so, you know, the adult is just where we slice it in terms of the context. So we're really thinking about ADHD as a developmental syndrome of impaired executive functions or self-regulations. How efficiently do you do what you set out to do? Which is the one factor that sort of describes it. But that breaks down into probably the more common problems that people present with, such as procrastination. I can't get myself to start something, even though I know I'll be better off later, but I don't feel like doing it now. Time management, which is like, not like, it is organizing behavior across time to get ready and out the door to catch the train on time, or the organizing behavior about a project. The advice our grandmothers would give us, chunk it into small steps, work on it a little bit so that way you're not rushing at the end. Stuff we all struggle with at times to a degree, but with individuals with ADHD of any age, they're more difficult. Now, the time projection we have for a seven-year-old and how much they're going to be able to organize by themselves across time is going to be different for a 17-year-old, different from 27, 47, you know, 67. And so the part of adulthood, which is more challenging, there's a developmental expectation for more independent self-regulation. And also the context that most people are dealing with, there's also responsibilities for other people. Parenting, being a partner in a relationship, being an employee, maybe a supervisor, other coordination of efforts with other people, where all of a sudden there's more ripple effects and more public-facing effects of ADHD, where there's most likely no end of the school year or end of the marking period where you can start over with a clean slate.
Yeah, and you know, certainly like the way that you're describing that, and hearing it as this kind of mounting or growing trajectory, just as we developmentally become more complex beings, the executive functioning concerns are presenting in more complex ways. I don't know that I've really thought about it in those terms, but we don't have that reset button. And you know, those behaviors that, you know, that are being done or maybe not done, they're having right. That long lasting piece that, you know, it ends up almost kind of starting behind and trying to make repairs or changes there. Right. Yeah.
And you know what? I probably cut myself off and didn't share the Barclay quote where he said calling ADHD and attention problems like calling autism eye gaze disorder. It's an element of it, but it doesn't capture the essence of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, you know, it's something we've kind of talked about in kind of other ways, is that, you know, I think that sometimes I think that's why it's misdiagnosed. We're focusing on very specific criteria, and there's such a functional impact. You know, I was sharing on another episode, you know, seeing someone who may get good grades because they're a good test taker, but they take 6 hours a night to study and do an hour's worth of homework. And the perception is, well, but they get good grades, like they're able to pass. But the work that kind of comes with it, and that executive function process is, I mean, it's grueling. Like, I mean, yeah, and it's and I think sometimes we don't, if we focus too much just on the inattention, we miss all of the work that I think some individuals have to put into this, especially as they hit college.
Oh, yeah. And then some of these many very hardworking people putting the 6 hours in, what one colleague said, working twice as hard for half as much. But that's the stuff that's hidden. The outcome is fine. Yo, B average, C average, that is perfectly fine. That's average, above average. But the unsustainable, as work gets harder and requires more time, at some point you reach a point of diminishing returns. So that's the hidden piece. Or as well as other people, you know, the parents, and this is good coping and it's loving coping, but the parents sitting with the child doing homework, because if they're left alone to do it and they need a little supervision, and then that's stressful for the family. So there's a lot of stories, and these are part of the things that, you know, somebody could come in and say, I'm a 4.0 student in college. I was valedictorian of my high school, but we want to hear, well, how have you achieved that? And there are cases of out and out cheating. I ran out of time. I had to do this. My parents finished my essay or, yeah, whatever. I called out sick from work because I'd fallen too far behind. It makes sense with the story, but it usually reflects these recurring patterns. People will say, doesn't everybody have a little bit of ADHD? Yeah, we can all have periodic executive functioning problems. If you have a bout of insomnia, your executive functioning will go down. If you have a bout of major depression or COVID, your executive functioning will go down. Or a newborn infant at home, yeah, that will cause the sleep problems. I hate to call having a newborn at home a condition, but as these conditions remit and you go back to baseline, your executive functioning goes back to baseline. The thing with ADHD, it's a moving target, or it's an undulating, unreliable baseline, which, you know, another appeal or what is fascinating about ADHD is it also gets at your sense of self. I can't rely on myself. I can't know that I will get study for the test. I got a great grade last time, but I don't trust that I'll be able to study as hard as I did then because there seems to be no rhyme or reason. And what Dr. Tom Brown calls, author of the Brown Attention Deficit Disorder scales, which have been supplanted by his new scales, the Brown Executive Functioning and Executive Function and Attention scales, he calls that the fundamental paradox of ADHD. Some settings, some activities you can do awesome. Hyper-focus, an athlete who, you know, is unblinking as a hockey goalie or something like that, but then give them a 100-word opinion piece. You don't even have to reference anything. Just your thoughts on the reading you did. They'll be late on that. So there's that consistent inconsistency in performance.
In some of the Psychology Today work and articles that you've been doing, you've talked about some of the impact that adult ADHD can have on, you know, physical health and on other aspects. What do you see as some of the most concerning factors related to some of those outcomes?
Right. Now, this comes from some interesting longitudinal research. What is interesting about it is the long reach of ADHD. I mean, I think I made it clear, but in case it's not, we all have the executive functions. This is part of normative human development. And it is a uniquely human trait. I mean, there's some of the social animals have some rudimentary, but to the level that we have where we can save for retirement, we can even have, you know, work towards delayed gains that have short-term costs, but longer-term benefits, including things we will not live to see completed, but we'll do it for the thought of how this might better people I'll never meet. And not anybody related, not your children, right? People you just don't know, you're not related to. So when you think about it, healthcare, personal health, well-being requires ongoing maintenance. So things like dental care, even and especially preventative care, going in when there's no reason to go in. What, you're telling me I have to go to the dentist when there's nothing wrong? Or at least we think there's nothing wrong? Various things, you know, the grandmother rules, diet and exercise. So some of the studies have found that at age 27, with children with ADHD tracked to age 27, some of them being no longer fulfilling diagnostic criteria, being sub-threshold by that point, and others, you know, with persistence. Some of the early work showed that there were risk factors for coronary heart disease, and there's been a separate population-based study, and I forget the country, so I won't. I think it's Sweden. Where they have found, like going through records, there's an increased incidence of cardiovascular disease in adults with ADHD. And a more recent shocking outcome from that cohort measured at age 27, where in some of the follow-up measures, there were several things associated with health behaviors, and the profile entered into an estimated life or expected life estimator, something like an actuarial table or something that an insurance company would use. At age 27, the health presentation of this group would suggest a lowered life expectancy by over a decade. Now, the encouraging thing as a psychologist and the psychosocial treatment, but also with the medications for a psychiatrist or psychologists with prescribing privileges, is that these are changeable behaviors, like diabetes risk, exercise, stopping smoking, weight. I don't think we're using BMI anymore, but that's not my area of expertise, so I don't want to speak out of school. These are changeable, but also says they should be targets for treatment. And sleep problems historically are ubiquitous within ADHD. So what is striking about it is these changeable factors. I mean, we all know, but again, ADHD is not a knowledge problem. It's that implementation problem. You know, doing the things, the preventative stuff. So that is a new area where we have more data now to back it up. And I think there's an increased movement to have these things be considered as part of any treatment plan. Sleep has already been, you know, part of that, but then these, you know, asking about these other factors and trying to get some headway there. The nice thing is some of the approaches we have for how do you get started on your homework, or the monthly reports you have to do for work, these can be easily repurposed for, you know, how do you get out for a walk after dinner and how do you limit whatever the good fat or bad fats are these days.
Right. You know, I guess since you mentioned kind of treatment and those interventions, I'm a person who's trained in cognitive behavior therapy as well, and I've done a lot of my work in that area. What does that treatment look like for ADHD? Like what would people be doing in therapy to help with some of those psychosocial factors?
No, that's a great question. I'll tell anybody that, you know, even though CBT emphasizes cognition, not exclusively, but that was, Dr. Beck's prescience and introduction, you know, into the psychotherapy literature, but you don't think yourself into having ADHD. So the cognitions are not a causal factor, but living with ADHD is going to affect your outlook, to a degree it can, your sense of self. Now, this will be on a continuum. Some people have very mild circumscribed difficulties that they say, no, my self-esteem's good. I'm always rushing at the last minute or things I arrive late. I want to change these things that will reduce my stress. And other people may be more complex with, you know, coexisting mood, anxiety, other factors. So how we frame it is it's really organized around the executive functions, and the workarounds for managing ADHD. And within each of these, the classic cognitive behavioral model, how does your mindset, how do your thoughts and the deeper beliefs affect what you're planning to do and your willingness to do it? So are there ways, how do you psych yourself out of doing what you're doing? This is no good. I don't feel like doing it. Well, do you have to feel like doing it? Are there other things you don't feel like doing? The central role, emotional regulation, is one of the executive functions. And you don't see emotions listed anywhere in any of the ICD or DSM criteria, but we now know it's a core feature. And so that being able to soothe upset feelings, downregulate, as well as what is motivation, it's the upregulation of emotions. One way to think about motivation, it's the ability to generate an emotion about a task in the absence of an immediate consequence. Make yourself feel enough like studying for the midterm 3 days in advance. And with emotions, I've made the contention just based on my own hypothesis, but that managing that sort of discomfort of getting started on a task you really don't feel like doing, but you know it's the right thing, that is like one of the central, at least in CBT, at least the emotional management task. And then the behavior is really the use of the coping strategies and, you know, engagement with the things that you want to do. And this is also things of your choice, your pursuits, like taking a class or whatever and using the coping strategies for that. And there's, when I outlined it, what I view as the different components of the CBT for adult ADHD. So the cognition, my contention is, you know, self-mistrust is the main cognitive theme within ADHD. And that was based on a question Tony Rostain and I were asked at probably one of our first big presentations of the model back in 2002. But it was like one of these things that stuck with me over the year. An attendee asked, well, what's the main cognitive theme in adult ADHD? So within the cognitive model, even though the cognitive distortions and how you approach the thoughts are, you know, very similar, but every, for lack of a better phrase, condition has its own theme. So depression is dealing with the theme of loss, loss of opportunity, loss of esteem. With anxiety, it's dealing with threat or risk. And what we're really understanding more recently, which I think is particularly relevant for ADHD, intolerance of uncertainty. Because ADHD is an uncertainty generating machine. It's an entropy generating machine. And then with emotions, it is dealing with the discomfort of I'm going to do something that's going to be hard or that I don't want to do, or it's going to take me longer, even objectively, than it would somebody else. Behavior is the engagement versus disengagement. Escape avoidance is the most common coping reaction. And there's evidence of this, empirical evidence of this among adults with ADHD. And then there's an implementation domain about based on Peter Galwitzer's implementation intention strategies, if X, then Y statements. If I put air in my tires, then I will take my bike outside for a bike ride. Or if I can sit down at my desk, then I can work on my homework for 10 minutes has been shown to be a very helpful self-regulation strategy. And then within the interpersonal social domain, I talk about wielding social capital. It's an analogy for viewing relationships as accounts, because part of the thinking about why we have executive functions at all, and this comes from a lovely book by Russ Barkley, surprise, surprise, but that it comes from early humans living in larger and larger groups of non-genetically related humans. So working and playing well with others, reciprocity, following through, not being difficult, being able to keep your frustration and anger in check within reason, but also being able to tell if somebody's not following through and things like that. And I've had clients say this things like this verbatim, feeling like I start a relationship expecting how am I going to disappoint this person, or almost like starting with a one down, almost like right. They're starting off with building an account, but already feel they're in debt, which can lead to holding back on self-advocacy, looking out for yourself, things like that. So that's sort of the overview about the different domains, how I see, just for illustration purposes and understanding, but also some of the central targets that we work on, usually around specific examples in somebody's life, a relationship they're dealing with, a pursuit that they want to, they are after, or managing the day-to-day business of life and being a parent, being a partner, whatever roles, managing your adult roles.
Certainly, I think aware of these, you know, whether they're strategies, you know, within the cognitive theory, but, you know, hearing them all coming together and really it's this specific targeting of each of these elements of executive functioning or executive dysfunction in terms of ADHD, and trying to then make accommodations there, and even taking it, you know, beyond, especially when we're talking about the complexities that are present there with, you know, with adults, especially in that relationship piece and that social capital, and being able to help to reframe that and challenge that view of I'm coming in, because it creates those disingenuous relationships, or, you know, that troubles with motivation already. If I'm going in expecting to fail, you know, it creates those patterns. And so hearing how important kind of the entirety of the approach is.
Right. And even going back to the relationships, even exploitative relationships like gaslighting or abuse or whatever, where somebody feels like, well, I must deserve this or whatever. I mean, those are extreme examples. And not losing sight, sometimes the concerns are accurate. The adult with ADHD in a relationship, let's just say a marriage of any sort, doesn't follow through on a promise. Spoiler alert, that's very upsetting to relationship partners. And there is there are benefits of psychoeducation of the, if you will, the non-ADHD partner that can be helpful to not personalize it. But then, you know, as a clinician, I always try to be respectful of the person not in the room, saying, I don't know what that person's dealing with. And maybe this is a trigger for them and whatever past other relationships they may have had. So even if my client obviously isn't doing it on purpose and feels bad and is working on it, you don't know the other person's journey. So it can be, you know, fraught at times. And what was I going to say there? You know, usually the person in treatment's working on it, and usually with some psychoeducation and understanding. And you know, I'm not doing the couples therapy, but very often what people describe, or somebody comes in for a psychoeducational session with the partner, that can lead to a uniquely intimate discussion of, you know, here are my weak points, and can, you know, can I trade off this household chore? I'll take this on because I'm better at it. Could you pick this up? Or, and that sort of sharing is, it's why I lost my job at Hallmark. I'm not going to be able to sell any Valentine's Day cards with this sort of verbiage, but witnessing it, it can be, you know, very intimate and building a healthy bond.
And I think one of your articles in Psychology Today, I think, dives into that a little bit deeper. And I want to say even the term, I believe it was neurointimacy. And
yes,
you know,
yes.
You're describing that process, and you know, whether it's in the session or you know, done, you know, just between the couple themselves, but the value of that checking in, and a very attentive checking into the executive dysfunction and concerns that are present, at least with the individual with ADHD. Yeah.
Right, right. And even like a non-ADHD partner may go, you know what, I could do this thing, but if you want to take it on, yeah, take it, because I don't like doing this chore, and give me this and I'm better at that, or whatever. Yeah, there still has to be a follow through. But yeah, it just seemed like a, you know, neuro is a prefix for a lot of things these days. So I figure I'd just throw it in there and see if it flies.
Certainly is appreciated.
Russell, on kind of the other end of the spectrum here with, you know, we're talking about some of the deficits and how we work with those. Are there kind of these hidden benefits or maybe strengths that individuals with adults with ADHD may have that kind of use that as maybe a way to promote their success?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting work. Some interview studies with quote unquote high functioning adults with ADHD and entrepreneurs. So things like the ability with divergent thinking. And there is a research in general on what's called mind wandering, which might be a fancy way of saying daydreaming, even though there might be a difference between the two. One of my favorite comedians is Stephen Wright, and he said something like, I was trying to daydream, but my mind kept wandering. But you know, in mind wandering, like if you're mowing the lawn, you're doing something, but you really don't have to focus and our mind goes, that's where we might come up with solutions to problems we've been rolling over, like non-conscious processes where we go, oh, I know the transition sentence for this paragraph I was stuck on in writing, or, oh yeah, I figured, you know, I figured out why that thing's not working in the kitchen or something. And I'm not a handy guy, so that's probably not a very apt description for me. That is a human capacity, and that can be very adaptive. There is also maladaptive mind wandering.
Right.
There is maladaptive mind reading too, where it can get in the way. And that's part of what folks with ADHD may struggle with. It's like the shift between when we need focus or versus when we something isn't as engaging. And that's been one of the issues with the inattentive side of ADHD, but that divergent thinking that can come with the mind wandering and seeing things differently. And I've had at least one colleague say, just living with ADHD and the workarounds maybe require looking at things differently and personalizing them and, you know, whatever we want to call it. So there's elements of that. Also the energy, being energized in terms of passion about a topic or a project, as well as the, you know, being able to do things longer, hard to keep up with. I was going to say something else in there. The hard to keep up with. Oh, and then the hyper focus, being able to stay on things for longer and pay attention to them. Now, this is like Goldilocks. Too little, too cool, too hot, just right. too little focus, you're not getting anything done. Hyper-focus can turn into perseveration. I'm going to keep doing this and not stop when I need to disengage and move on to the other homework assignment or something like that. So it is, these are some of the things that are involved in looking. And you know, another factor is goodness of fit. What am I doing? What type of class is this? Is this a hands-on project related class, or is there a lot of reading and essays and things like that? Now, we can't necessarily engineer everything, but understanding and finding those good fits, the character strengths, if you will, and trying to find venues in which those can be actualized better, including, and I think society is getting more open to the neurodivergence and interacting with teachers and workplaces, and even workplaces seeking this out. How can we support our neurodivergent employees? What are ways the traditional office does not work for them? Probably number one being the open office space, which I think has been found not to be useful for most employees, but also some research, not specific to ADHD, but looking at, yeah, it's very good brainstorming with a group, but then you need to be able to go into a closed off space somehow to collect your thoughts and organize them and assimilate them. That if you're around people all the time, that's a high cognitive load. You're going to tire out your brain just dealing with everybody else. We need that break in there. But going back to the strengths, you know, finding the settings that are very hands-on, project-based, where you can see progress, which is part of the externalization of information. That's part of the coping. So I think there are some ways I've used the analogy with some clients that it is like, your diet. Some people are able to eat as much as they want, whenever they want, with no ill effects. They can have 3-alarm chili at midnight and fall asleep right away. Somebody else has a whiff of caffeine at 12 PM and they're up till 3 AM and they can't sleep. So I think, now, this is a hypothesis, but individuals with ADHD might have a narrower band in terms of what are good fits for them and more sensitive to poor, much more sensitive to poor fits. I think that's part of the work that we do and, you know, coaches do and individuals are trying to do themselves, trying to figure out where do I work best and what are the best opportunities I can put myself in.
I love that. When you referenced kind of the Goldilocks kind of metaphor, because I think I find myself doing that a lot with patients. It's just kind of saying, you know, too much in this setting is not good, not enough. And how do we find that just right in the moment? And right. You're using some of those executive function strategies that you kind of talked about earlier to help bring them to that just right. And, at least in my experience, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on this. I think it's very different for every person I see, like that just right fit for all of these things. It's very individualized. And, you know, so I kind of feel like every case is brand new. There's not a set way that we can address it. Do you find that in your work as well?
Yeah. I mean, across the board, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean that, and even with, you know, as you well know, Ray, in the early days of CBT, the treatment manuals were bashed as cookbooks or like things, but they are designed to be personalized. They were from day one. It's just, if you're doing an NIH study, as Dr. Beck was, as like Steve Safran did for his, right. Mastering Your Adult ADHD manual, they're not going to say, yeah, go ahead for a few years, see how many sessions it takes. No, they're going to say it needs to be 20 sessions, whatever. Right. What are you going to do each session? So it's sort of a conceit of getting funded for it, but the clinicians, if they go like with Safran's group, they start off with the planner. If somebody needs outside any sort of study, if they need 3 sessions honing in on a planner, you're going to take 3 sessions. So that's part of the personalization. And even with the coping strategies within ADHD, what is the line in the ADHD community? If you've met one person with ADHD, well, then you've met one person with ADHD. Yeah. As opposed to if you've met one, if you've seen one, you've seen them all.
Right.
And you know, calling the manuals cookbooks, well, in a way, what I'll, and I was just doing it this morning, saying to somebody, you know, we'll talk about some of the strategies like a planner. And I might have an approach, a recipe, if you will, of here's how it might work. But it is like a recipe. If you go, I don't like that ingredient, I want to change it with this, or I want to season it this way. Right. That's what it's designed to do. The starting point isn't necessarily the end point. Now, I think the quick fix gets a bad rap because I would like a quick fix. If I'm going in for, you know, if I have a sinus infection and I'm getting an antibiotic and I get the 5-day one, I'm not going, can I have the 3-week one? You know, can I stretch this out a little longer? No, we want to feel, but sometimes it does take some iteration. And even with the 5-day, it might be day 3 until we really feel better or whatever the case may be. But you know what? That's another thing where the ADHD community, you know, one myth is it's people looking for the easy way out. And if you've ever met somebody with ADHD, there is no easy way out. In fact, it's some of the hardest working people you've ever seen. They're twice as hard for half as much. Another is looking for the quick fix. Now, most people are just looking for some reliable, reasonable sense of cause and effect. I want to know, even if it takes me 2 hours to read the 25-page chapter that it only takes my roommate 40 minutes to read, I just want to know within reason, if I read it and review it and take some notes, that I'll pass the class. I don't have to be CEO of some company or whatever. That might be like in somebody's cards or later on, but it's just, I just want to know it's not for nothing. Pardon the double negative. So it's really humbler things, but still massively important things because it's the little stuff that adds up to, you know, the bigger stuff. But that's why ADHD leads to like that cognitive theme I mentioned, the self-mistrust. I don't know how it's going to work. So we're just trying to improve the ratio where somebody's, you know, has more of that self-trust and along the way, self-compassion for, the times that we all invariably slip up, but then the confidence that, okay, if I get back to doing this, I'm reasonably sure it'll work well.
And Russ, I'm left wondering, I might be putting you on the spot here, so I hope not, but how do you view the treatment outcome for individuals with adult ADHD, especially with just the boom in terms of technological development, and especially with that impact in terms of, you know, attention and being able to maintain focus and that instant access that technology gives us, as well as the vast resources that it gives us. And so, you know, how do you view that in terms of being adaptive in terms of treatment, as well as what are some of the biggest risks involved with the reliance on it?
No, that's a great question. I mean, there's still some of the literature I haven't dived into as much as I would like, but about what, because now we have generations growing up with like access to technology and phones, which can be great for keeping track of your teenagers and kids and things like that. But there's also the downside. So just what that does to our neurons. But on a more day-to-day level, you're right. I've used the analogy, like dealing with technologies, like dealing with an eating disorder. You can't do a 28-day detox from food, like if you're having problems with it or issues with it, with all respect. You're not, I guess you literally could, but in most situations, you're going to have a healthy relationship with technology. So yeah, the coping tool that you're using for your to-do list or your planner is also your biggest escape route from anything, anywhere, as well as if we're talking about on the behavioral side, incentivizing, well, how do you reward yourself after you do something? We're having the rewards all day. You know, it's not that special, because that's something, if you really want a reinforcer to work, you only get, you know, whatever it is after you do this particular task. Yeah, you know, sort of like training the dog. If you wanted to do it, catch a frisbee, it only gets this liver flavored treat that it likes with the frisbee. So that way, it's a very strong connection. So it is something we talk about, like the psychoeducation about the risks and about the power of negative reinforcement, which is not punishment. It is reinforcement increases the likelihood that you'll do the behavior again. Negative is removing something uncomfortable. So it's exactly what happens when we escape work to go on our phone and check social media. We get that relief. Ah, I know I have to go, my cortex knows I have to go back to work, but I'm going to check this or see what's going on or whatever. So now education is not enough. ADHD is not a knowledge problem. It's a performance problem. It is. Now, I will always tell clients, right of self-determination, you don't have to do these things. But if there is, depending on the tasks you're doing, can you put your laptop on airplane mode? So at least there's another step you have to do. It may only be a click. It may be things like logging off of your social media accounts. So you have to enter your passcode and password. Your user ID and passcode, I should say. Little tricks like that to have a delay. Mm-hmm. But these sorts of in the moment, identifying for this person, what are their particular risks? And are there ways we can engineer their environment where and how they do things, delay phone use, have it out of reach, pretty inelegant stimulus control stuff. But we also know stimulus control works really well. If you want to stop smoking cigarettes, don't have cigarettes around the house.
Absolutely.
So in the behavioral side, yes, it is an ongoing challenge. And it is a temptation around us all the time.
And I find myself when working with clients who have adult ADHD, trying to talk with them about kind of setting themselves up for success and automating as much of that as possible. And, certainly when the moment I arrive here at the office, I have a specific location set up that my notifications narrow down from everything in my phone to these people can contact me. And, everyone else, it gets a message that notifications are off or locking out certain applications from myself while here. Like, so just being able to limiting that access and exactly what you're saying, creating just one more step or barrier to get to that reinforcer that shouldn't be, that really isn't being used properly then. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think there are a lot more apps and technologies for those very things that will limit certain things, everything that you just described, automating that. And as well as some of the coping, automating bill payments and, things like that, reminders for appointments. It's been a blessing and a curse at the same time.
Yes.
Yeah. And with talking about technology, one of the things we're hearing a lot is frustration sometimes from clinicians regarding the TikTok craze of everybody having adult ADHD. And have you kind of seen that and, that kind of uptick of people that believe they have it because someone described it on a TikTok video?
Right.
And if so, how would you suggest clinicians maybe approach clients in that situation?
I think we've been a little protective because we've usually run a bit of a waiting list. So if somebody says, I saw this on TikTok, I want to get in today to get an appointment and it's not happening. I think we have effectively extinguished that behavior. How I view it is one, especially during the pandemic where more people are reaching out for care. I think it overall, there'll be individual items, but I think overall it was a positive trend of people who might have struggled with it. Maybe the adjustment to the pandemic tweaked something that was there, but that big shift, working from home without the cues of being in the office and also the protective factors. I'm at the office, I can't do X, Y, or Z, but now I have to let my dogs out in the middle of the day too, or whatever the case may be. It shed light on something that somebody might have gone back and forth about, but now they had time. So I think in general, that's been a positive. A way I think about it, thinking about it like it's a screening measure. And like any other screening, like the adult ADHD symptom rating scale by the WHO is like a 6-item screener. Screeners are designed, or it could be a diabetes risk or whatever. They are designed to cast a wider net. Most screeners are willing to accept some false positives to get more true positives. And so that's how we can think about TikTok. Now, the screener doesn't mean, the 6-item ADHD screener, you screen positive, here's your Adderall or, whatever. Right. Sorry, I didn't mean to use a brand name. Here's your sting.
Yeah, that's all right.
okay. Then it's incumbent. And again, access is still an issue, but I think it was better with the pandemic and remote treatment and hybrid assessment and treatment. And I don't think that's going to go back, which I think is another positive from a tragic situation. But then it's incumbent to get a thorough evaluation that includes things like, even though limited for the reasons I mentioned, includes DSM criteria, including evidence of childhood emergence. You don't have to have been diagnosed with ADHD before or even retrospectively endorse diagnostic levels, but just that many symptoms, now more than one or two, but many symptoms emerged and seemed to be causing problems, even if they weren't causing impairments then. Now, this could be an otherwise A student getting B's, the not fulfilling potential that we'll hear people say. Now, we could existentially say, well, if you never fulfill potential, was that your potential? But that's, you know, the tree falls in the woods type of question. But, you know, documenting childhood onset here and now, the wider assessment of beyond DSM of some measure of executive functions or other adult ADHD scale, screening, if not outright assessing for potential comorbidities, or they could be not comorbidities, but rather the explanation for the attention problems. All that glitters is not gold. All that is distracted is not ADHD. And concentration problems show up on the Beck depression inventory. They're common for anxiety. They're, you know, pretty much attention problems. They're like a fever in medical practice. You have the fever. Well, that could be the flu or COVID. It could be an infection. It could be malaria. We need more information. So there are good protocols out there. Many sufficient measures that could be used for, I think some of these, like the World Health Organization, and you could come up with your own DSM scale if you have the DSM. And there's a lot of guidance out there for what to do, or at least referrals where now there's still access problems in terms of affordability, access to people with experience with ADHD, but I think it's getting better. And there's like I said, more generation coming up who want to specialize in ADHD across the lifespan, and more centers around where with the remote treatment like SciPact for psychologists, we've been able to utilize that to help people who otherwise wouldn't have been able to make it into Philadelphia or even Pennsylvania. Yeah.
I appreciate you reframing TikTok for me as a screening measure. So that is a cognitive therapy tool right there. That was because I don't know if I viewed it like that. And after kind of like really hearing that explanation, that really for me, I'm like, yeah, that really did probably open up at least the potential to be screened. Right. And yeah, we still need good evaluation, but it's
now,
easy to
discount.
I'm not
on TikTok,
that.
So I've not seen any of them. So there might be some that I go, oh my gosh, what are they thinking? But yeah, but also realizing that a lot of people might say, sure, oh, that's me or whatever. But a lot of people probably don't have discretionary income or time, or it's probably usually the other problem with most people, not just ADHD, like, okay, if this is something, what am I going to do about it? When and follow up treatment and, you know, whatever. So we're still running up against those barriers. So it's not like, now this is where we could say some of the, I don't know details about each of them, so I'm just going to create this phrase, but let's just say online therapy mills. Now that's the other thing. How many people can get quick access without, adequate evaluation. And we're not talking like somebody trying to make a good faith effort with limited resources who, you know, sounds like they're on the right track. And, you know, I know in our reports, and I always tell my trainees in our reports, we have diagnostic impressions. We might spend a lot of time with somebody, but we could get new information, or, you know, we're not finished. So other things may be going on or come on play. So it's trying to be more humble in what we do, but we also we'll give the rationale for all our clients. That way we say, we might be wrong, but we want to be transparent. This is how we put everything together. And I think people seem to appreciate that. So even if sometimes we'll have people that we go, yeah, this is sub-threshold, or we can't verify childhood onset, at least our behavioral treatment could be helpful, whatever we want to call this. It's usually people get up in arms about the medications, though. That's usually where the controversy comes in with any over or misdiagnosis.
So, Russ, we like to kind of end our episodes with some takeaways for our listeners. And sure. So we're going to kind of end with just a couple short questions. But so we're the Psych to Practice podcast, and we, we want to kind of, we're interested in what keeps you psyched to do what you do.
On a self-care standpoint, exercise. I used to play in an over 30 men's soccer league, which, and still really good friends with those guys. But now I'm Greg Lemond, but I was reading a book about Greg Lemond, the Tour de France, the only legitimate U.S. Tour de France champion, where they call this mammals, middle-aged men in Lycra. So I like bike riding now. But you know what? What keeps me psyched? I remember one of the grand rounds at Penn, the presenter said, you can't call yourself an expert if you don't see clients in whatever you do. And so I think it's our work is hard work, but it is rewarding work. So I think that keeps me energized, and even like, you know, and also the opportunity to do things like this. I was getting starting to flag a little bit in the afternoon, but you know, getting talking about this stuff and good questions and your guys' insights, that sort of interplay of ideas with colleagues and whatnot, that's energizing, and being able to share information with people. Supervising trainees. So fortunately with psychology, there's a lot of different things you can do that even if one area you go, oh, I feel like I don't know anything or I haven't helped anybody today, but you can probably move to something else. So again, within that topic, but also getting out, somebody got me this, if you can read it, it says, I'm a psychologist, but with a bicycle on it. getting out and doing something just visceral, and that this all, I think, works together to get me psyched and my endurance for what I and you guys, the type of work we all do.
Wonderful. And if you could give kind of new clinicians or listeners kind of three maybe gems or takeaways you've kind of learned along the way in your career, what would those be?
At least the ones that worked for me, seek challenging mentors, talented, but challenging. And it doesn't mean or difficult, just that, you know, if they tell you you're doing a good job, that's something you want to remember. That's a compliment. Right. I would say the degree that you have, wring it dry, get the most out of it, see what works for you. And that might mean one area that you specialize in, research or clinical, but get the most out of it. You've worked hard enough to get it. Say yes to things. Give it a try. Gather experiences. And then lastly, I would say just persistence. That's part of executive functioning, but the persistence to get into graduate school, to get through grad school, whatever it might be, setting up a private practice, looking for a different practice, finding the right fit for you. But, you know, sort of keep moving. And it might be changing course along the way, or it might be staying on a course. But, you know, persistence with reasonable flexibility. It's, you know, it's again, Goldilocks in a way. But, that's I think they've all served me pretty well.
And kind of final question. We all read all these different books through our career. If you could kind of maybe give us one that you think's worth those in the profession to look at, what would you suggest?
You know what? I'm going to do one that's more of a professional read and another one that still I think psychologists would really like. Okay. The professional one, you know, sort of 1A and 1B. I like David Barlow's series on the treatment of psychological disorders. So it's like probably in the fifth or sixth edition. Yeah. So that's one I said before when I had an earlier edition. If I was on a desert island starting a clinic, that's the one book, because it provides like a little manual chapter. Each chapter is like a mini manual. But the other one more related to, not specific to ADHD, is the Handbook of Self-Regulation, edited by Kathleen Vohs, V-O-H-S, and Roy Baumeister, a very noted social psychologist, which it's not, again, Russell Barkley had a chapter, I think, in the third edition, but I found that to be a really enjoyable professional read. Now, the one that is a more popular read is by Michael Lewis, the author of Moneyball and The Big Short and things like that. Yeah. The Undoing Project. It is the story of Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, who their claim to fame is heuristics and biases. You know, things like the hindsight bias and things like that. So it's how they came to know each other, work with each other, and eventually later on they had a falling out. But also, it's a very nice synopsis of their research. And later on, Kahneman, you know, and they were probably both on track to get the Nobel Prize, but Tversky died young, and they don't give it posthumously. And then, you know, sort of how they had the falling out, and then Kahneman, you know, eventually getting it several years ago now. But it's just a wonderful story about their friendship and how they're, but it's also their research track, and it's a nice synopsis of heuristics and biases by a very noted author. So I always found that an enjoyable and educational read.
It's funny. We actually just did an episode talking about biases, and both of those names came up. So, I was not familiar with this book. So, I appreciate that.
Oh yeah, no, that's a good one. You know what they said about Amos Tversky in the book? They said it was called the world's shortest IQ test. Now, Tversky was considered an intellect on par with Einstein. Was how smart he was. Mm. And they said the shortest IQ test is the longer you're in Amos Tversky's presence without realizing that you're the dumber of the two, the dumber you are. So for what it's worth.
Russ, thanks so much for taking a Friday afternoon to talk with us. This was fantastic. I could go for another hour, but we want to respect everybody's time. Appreciate that. So thanks so much.
Yes, truly, thank you.
It was as fun for me as it was for you. So I appreciate that.
And with that, we hope this episode got you psyched, and we want to thank you all for listening. And we certainly want to extend that big thank you to Dr. Russell Ramsey for joining us on today's episode and really diving in depth on adult ADHD. Russ, if our listeners are interested in learning more, where can they follow you at or hear more about what you're doing?
I have a personal/professional website, and I post like other podcasts I've done and materials. So, The website is www.CBT4ADHD.com. Now, CBT, as in Thomas, not CBD. Some people hear I'm an expert in CBD for, at least that's how they hear it anyway, but that's the website. I'm on Twitter at CBT for ADHD. LinkedIn, and you can check out my Psychology Today blog disclosure. I think I get 0.0001 cent per hit. So that's my financial disclosure for the website. I think I have the math right for the Psychology Today, but you can also access it through my website too.
Absolutely. Well, certainly, you know, really hoping that, our listeners, especially who have that passion for ADHD, are taking that opportunity to go and learn more, or read more, or, you know, just staying up to date with it. And if you're interested in hearing more and staying up to date with us here at the Psych to Practice podcast, you can visit our website at www.psychtopractice.com, or you can follow us on all major social media by searching Psych to Practice. Also, if you've enjoyed this episode, again, it means so, so much for us when you're able to review it. Really, those reviews are driving us, helping us trend on the, you know, all of the platforms out there. So Apple Music and Spotify, and also word of mouth. So sharing the podcast with anyone you know that's interested in psychology or mental health, it means so much. Be well and stay psyched. The information contained in this podcast and on the Psych to Practice website is intended for informational and educational purposes only. Nothing in this podcast or on the website is intended to be a substitute for professional, psychological, psychiatric, educational, or medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please note that no professional patient relationship is formed here, and similarly, no supervisory or consultative relationship is formed between the host, guests, and listeners of this podcast. If you need the qualified advice of a mental health professional or practitioner, please contact services in your area. Similarly, if you need supervision on clinical matters, please locate a supervisor with experience to fit your professional needs.